Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the July 16, 2017 edition of the program. In the Jewish calendar, we count the 22nd of Tammuz, 5777. I am Walter Bingham, and I am pleased that you welcome me into your office, your home or car, wherever you are listening, and I hope that Walter's World informs you, and hopefully at times even entertains you. I am devoting a large part of this program to the launch of an organization that believes Israel has failed completely in its approach to solve the Palestinian-Arab-Israeli conflict. It's the Israel Victory Project that advocates a proactive victory stance rather than the hitherto looking over our shoulder to the world's attitude, colored by their commercial interests, particularly oil, as well as more than a hint of antisemitism. I am sure that you will find the extracts from the speeches I have selected most informative, and you may even agree. You will also hear an item that I believe is almost like finding the lost city of Atlantis. It's about the National Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. If you've never heard of it, you will be amazed. But I begin with the unusual reception of an African president. If you can place Rwanda on the map, you are good. It is, in fact, the smallest country in East Central Africa, landlocked and situated just below the equator. The country has struggled with its legacy of ethnic tension associated with a traditionally unequal relationship between the Tutsi minority and the majority Hutus. It is now trying to recover from the ethnic strife that culminated in government-sponsored genocide in the mid-1990s. In this genocide, an estimated 1 million ethnic Tutus, moderate Hutus, as well as Twa, a tribe of Pygmies, were killed by dominant Hutu forces in 100 days. The Army of Liberation from this genocide was commanded by Paul Kagame, who since the year 2000 is president of Rwanda. Under his leadership, Rwanda is striving to rebuild its economy, with coffee and tea production among its main exports. The World Bank has praised Rwanda's recent remarkable development successes, which it says have helped reduce poverty and inequality. We'll continue with this and another most interesting subject after this break.
Hey, it's Ari Fuld at Israel News Talk Radio. If you, like me, are sick and tired, if you've had enough of listening to all the anti-Israel lies and propaganda that's being spread online and offline, in the press, in the newspapers, on TV channels, in the newsrooms across the world, tune into my weekly show, Bulletproof, on Thursdays at 5 p.m. as we discover, expose, and completely destroy all anti-Israel lies and propaganda, and we're going to do it with just the truth. As an active IDF reserve soldier and elite paratroopers unit, I will try to give you an inside look to the opinions of the men and women of the IDF on the situation. Bulletproof will give you the tools. More importantly, will give you the weapons to take down all anti-Israel activists, no matter where you meet them. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. Israel time to Bulletproof on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
The World Bank has praised Rwanda's recent remarkable development successes, which it says have helped reduce poverty and inequality. On the other hand, in a scathing article, the British newspaper The Guardian wrote, Kagame claims to stand up to Western imperialism, though he is himself a stark example of it. Elected in rigged polls, applauded by the West, his government relies on Western funding and military support to maintain power, the very definition of imperialism. Such ironies are lost in popular narratives of Kagame. There is credible evidence of massacres by Kagame's forces of tens or hundreds of thousands of people after Rwanda's 1994 genocide, and his political opponents are almost all in exile, in prison or dead. Now, why do I tell you all that? It is because President Kagame was this week on a state visit to Israel and was, as is customary, received at the official residence of Israel's President Reuven Rivlin. His visit was deemed so important that Prime Minister Netanyahu decided to come to the president's residence to join in the welcome, which was, to my best knowledge and belief, unprecedented. The reason will become clear when you hear what President Rivlin said.
I know this is not your first time here, but every visit to Jerusalem is special. And I know that this visit in particular will serve the strengthening of the friendship between our peoples. Mr. President, I want to congratulate you on your recent speech at AIPAC. And I would like to use your words to say, Israel, without question, a friend of Rwanda. We are two nations who understand the horror of genocide. And we must show what humanity can achieve with cooperation and understanding. Indeed, we are not just friends through Mashav and other cooperation and partnership. We are working together to solve some of the biggest issues facing humanity: water and food security. Your Excellency, we appreciate the work done by your foreign minister, who has visited here and attended the funeral of the late President Shimon Peres, God bless his soul. She has been a strong voice in supporting Israel. We know that Rwanda is now going to be a member of the UN Human Rights Council. This is a body which is always against Israel, unfortunately. So we welcome all those who are prepared to speak for us. And we appreciate your support very much. It is a pleasure. It is a pleasure once again to welcome you here in Jerusalem. God bless you and all the people of Rwanda.
Prime Minister Netanyahu said this about Kagame.
Thank you, President Rivlin, for expressing what all Israelis feel when it comes to Rwanda. When it comes to you, President Kagame, your foreign minister, your delegation, you are welcome from the heart, from our hearts, to the heart of our people, Jerusalem. You are coming back here. This is not the first time. But I can say that in one of our earlier meetings, I had voiced the hope that Israel could come back to Africa in a big way, and that Africa could come back to Israel in a big way. And we discussed this for some time. And you said, well, I think I can help. And in fact, you did help. I would say you were the indispensable bridge on which we marched to make our return to Africa, step by step, with very sound advice, very, very wise counsel. And together we charted this course, coming first to West Africa, where we visited, among other things, your beautiful country, which is making impressive progress under your leadership, and then other countries as well, and then West Africa, and we'll be making a third trip very soon, 1 year. But I have to say that it began with my conversations with President Paul Kagame. So I want to thank you, Paul, for helping Israel in Africa, helping Israel in general. Thank you, Mr. President. President Rivlin has already mentioned the fact that we possess both of our peoples a tragic legacy, ours in the Holocaust, you in the great genocide that befell your people. I'm not sure how many of my Israeli compatriots know that President Kagame personally led the military effort that put a stop to this carnage after more than 1 million people were butchered, 1 million children, women, defenseless men. And with your courage, you put an end to this and began rebuilding this torn nation And we could see the impressive gains that you are making. In fact, it is one of our deepest pleasures to be able to cooperate with you in rebuilding your state, rebuilding it in agriculture and water and so many other areas, in security as well. We have pledged, I think, both our peoples, one simple pledge: never again. Never again. We who witnessed the greatest Holocaust in history, you who have witnessed perhaps one of the most recent ones, never again. That's another great bond between us. You have been a consistent friend to us, first in our bilateral relations. We don't forget that your foreign minister visited us during our travails in Gaza. You sent her as a show of friendship and solidarity. But we also see how you stand up for Israel in international forums. You already expressed a simple principle that we believe in. That is that bilateral relations should be reflected in multilateral forums. There is a dissonance, obviously, between us and quite a few nations still. We saw that in the absurd vote in UNESCO that said that, King David there, depicted there with a harp, King David was not in Jerusalem. He was in Tibet. His son, Solomon, didn't build the temple here. He built it in South America, I don't know. I mean, it's absurd, the whole denial of history, the denial of the Bible. These absurdities still take place in international forums, and they do damage to those forums. They cannot change the truth. But it happens to be my hope that over time, over a decade, this will change in international forums. There's one country that I could say categorically, it doesn't require a change. It already speaks its mind and speaks the truth in our bilateral relations and in the international relations. And that's Rwanda, under the leadership of President Paul Kagame. This is why, another reason why, we welcome you here in Israel with open hearts, open arms. Welcome, Mr. President.
President Kagame replied,
"Thank you very much, Excellency Reverend Rivlin, President of the State of Israel, Right Honorable Prime Minister, my friend Benjamin Netanyahu, senior officials, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. I'm very pleased to be back in Israel, and I would like to thank the President, the Prime Minister, and the government of Israel for this opportunity to reaffirm and deepen our very friendly relationship between Israel and Rwanda. Cooperation between our countries has blossomed in many areas, among them technology, agriculture, and energy, as well as security. We appreciate what Israel has to offer in these and other fields, and we are very happy to be working with you. Trade and investment links have also multiplied. Rwanda is open for business, and we look forward to welcoming private sector delegations from Israel even more frequently in the future. Ever since the Prime Minister's historic visit to East Africa last year, Israel has continued to follow through on its commitments and objective of scaling up engagement across Africa. This is a very positive trend, which can only be welcomed and merits our support. We are looking forward to reinforcing our collaboration with Israel on common challenges and issues of mutual interest. Thank you once again for the very kind words from President Rivlin, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and thank you once again for hosting our delegation today and for honoring the special ties of friendship that connect our nations. Thank you so much.
Did you catch the reason for these accolades heaped upon the president of East Africa's smallest country? Rwanda will become a member of UNESCO's Heritage Committee, a most important vote at their anti-Israel decisions. Welcome, President Kagame.
You will often have heard it said that countries have no friends, only interests. Well, here is another proof of it. Of course, it works both ways. Now for another quick break.
Howdy from the heartland. This is David Hartree. Would you like to know what it's like to live in the wild West Bank? No, that is a mistake. This is the heartland of Israel, Judea, and Samaria. Israel is under attack in social media, in the campuses, in newspapers. They are spreading lies and false information about Israel. Join me every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Israel time for my show, A Hebrew in the Heartland, and I am going to provide you tools that you can use to defend Israel, to protect this holy nation.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
This week saw the launch of the Israel Victory Project, conceived by Daniel Pipes, president of the Middle East Forum. It was at a packed Begin Heritage Center in Jerusalem where he introduced the project's concept, a new and different approach to address the Palestinian-Arab conflict, or I would call it Arab intransigence. Among the other speakers were member of Knesset Odette Forer of the Israel Beiteinu Party and chairman of the Knesset Israel Victory Caucus, Colonel Richard Kemp, CPE, former commander of the British forces in Afghanistan, and Times of London correspondent and author Melanie Phillips. The program began with a message from member of Congress from Ohio, Bill Johnson, who earlier this year started the Congressional Victory Caucus. Here is an extract from his recorded message.
I can't tell you how honored I am to be co-chairing the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus with my esteemed colleague, Representative Ron DeSantis of Florida. I first visited Israel in 2014. Boy, it was the dream of a lifetime to be able to visit the homeland of the Jewish people. And I can tell you, it had a profound impact on me personally and on my belief that Israel deserves the support of the American people. Ron DeSantis and I founded this caucus based on the principles that, first and foremost, Israel has a right to exist and defend herself. And that, my friends, is not negotiable. Israel has been at war with its immediate neighbors over its right to exist as the nation state of the Jewish people for nearly 70 years. It's our view that Israel has been victorious in this war, and that this reality, the reality that Israel has a right to exist and defend herself, must be recognized in order for any peace to be achieved between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors. So I want to say congratulations on the launch of our sister caucus, the Knesset Israel Victory Caucus. And I look forward to working with you to advocate for this new approach to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
You now hear Daniel Pipes.
It's a real delight to be here and to be pursuing this idea of Israel victory. In 1974, on the island of Lubang in the Philippines, a Japanese soldier was found who for 29 years had been battling on the Second World War. He didn't get the message that the war was over. Well, I think he's somewhat symbolic of the Palestinians who think the war is still on and that they can win. The Palestinian approach is to use violence and to engage in incitement and BDS and all these other methods to send a signal to Israelis that they're a crusader state that will be gone in some time. I think that's a folly, a delusion. In fact, the war is over. Israel's here. It's tough. It's strong. It's successful. It's creative. And so, thinking about this, it occurred to me that the U.S. government which has since December 1988, close to 30 years ago, been pursuing a policy of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. It is time for the government of the United States to recognize that it's not working. John Kerry, 4 years ago, put a huge effort into it, and we all knew before it even began that it wasn't going to work. And yet still it comes up, painful concessions on the part of Israel, and taking and asking for more, demanding more on the part of the Palestinians. So it occurred to me there should be a different approach. And what I as an American can do is to offer and develop an alternative to the peace processing, or what I like to call war processing. It's not working. So what's the alternative? I think the alternative is for the U.S. government to say to the Israeli government that within the boundaries of what is moral, what is legal, what is politically feasible, you, the Israeli government, should take steps to win this war, i.e. to convince the Palestinians that it's over, that you've lost. And what's so particularly attractive about this is that it's not only helpful to Israelis, who of course will benefit by not being attacked on a regular basis, whether violently or non-violently, politically, but it'll also help the Palestinians. Indeed, arguably the Palestinians gain more from this than the Israelis, because Israel is a flourishing country. So the Palestinians, need one point out, are not doing so well. At this moment in Gaza, in sweltering heat, there's not enough water, there's not enough electricity, and so forth. If you look around the West Bank and Gaza, you see very little being accomplished because there's this obsessive devotion to an irredentist folly to eliminating Israel. The Palestinians need to be convinced that this is a delusion, that it's not going to happen, that the gig is up, and they lost. So then they can move on to something better, more constructive, build their own polity, economy, society, and culture. So the American side is pretty clear. We want the U.S. government to say to Israel, to Israeli government, do what you need to do in the correct way. We're here in Israel, we Americans, not to tell Israelis what to do, but rather look for support so we can go back and say, according to polls, according to members of Knesset, and other indications, writings, analyses, there is support for this idea. It's not we Americans who are making this up. There is a base of support in Israel. I've been much stimulated in my few days here with ideas, critiques, improvements, taking it a new direction. And to suggest to you that you should prepare for the day when the U.S. government says to you, go ahead, do what you need to do. I'm constantly being asked about tactics. What does this mean specifically? And I constantly answer, I don't know, because I'm not here. I'm not a tactician. I'm not a colonel. I'm not a pollster. I don't know events, developments on the ground well enough to suggest, but I think that's something useful for Israelis to do. What would you do if the green light came from Washington? So it's in that spirit that we've come here, that we're launching unofficially tonight and officially in 2 days at the Knesset. This is a long-term thing. We're not planning for anything to happen in the next short period, but building so that there's a capacity in the future.
I would summarize in one sentence what Daniel Pipe said. We have to stop kicking the can down the road and start taking action. Now for an extract of what Knesset member Odette Forer suggested.
I don't think there are so many countries that so many people from all over the world are interested in their security. Winston Churchill once said, without victory, there is no survival. And this is something that Israel knew for decades. Of course, as you know, the wars hasn't started in 1948. It started when the first Jew came back to his homeland after 2,000 years of exile in the end of the 19th century. And of course, no one from our neighbors liked the fact that we come back to our ancestor land. And since then, we understood that we have to win. We have no choice. You know, my grandfather came to the city of Rehovot in 1890. And he knew back then that he needed to guard his home, his city, though he bought it just as Abraham bought the Machpelah cave with full money. But he needed to guard on this city over 120 years ago, and he needed to win. We are winning for over 100 years. We won before the reestablishment of Israel, and we won after the reestablishment of Israel. We won in 1948 and 56 and 67 and 73. And though we won in all those wars, yet our enemies hasn't accepted the fact that they lost, and we won. And this is one of the reasons that we haven't achieved peace yet in this region. Because when one country or one leader has understood that he lost, the fact that he accepted that he can't win and destroyed Israel as the land of the Jewish people. When Anwar Sadat understood that he won't be able to destroy Israel, he said, okay, now I will go and have a peace agreement. And since then, we have peace agreement with Egypt for 40 years almost. And when I look at the Palestinians, or the leadership, as we know, they haven't understood that they lost, that there is no way that Israel will vanish from the map. However, they still want to destroy Israel. They always try a different way. One of them, we saw in the decision that they promoted in UNESCO just a few days ago. Because we won in the battlefield, and of course we won in the economical field. They tried to boycott Israel, and of course we won the terror that they try to put on us every single day, and they lost. And when we try to find the solution, I think that we make a mistake. Because we need to know what is the precondition to a solution. We agree that Israel needs to be the land of the Jewish people. This is something that we can't negotiate on. The Palestinians try to negotiate. Abu Mazen tried to say two states. He will talk about the two-state solution. The Palestinian state clean of Jews, and then another state that later it will become binational, and eventually another Palestinian state. And this is something that we need to say to the all nations, and of course to the United States, which is our biggest ally. President Trump needs to tell Mahmoud Abbas that he needs to recognize Israel as the land of the Jewish people. And then we'll sit down and we can talk about what are his conditions, what are our conditions. But he needs to recognize the fact that he can't destroy Israel anymore. And this is a new approach that needs to take place in the international community. I think that this is a new narrative that we need to talk about. And this is a narrative we pray for peace all the time. We are going to celebrate this year 100 years for the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration talks about Israel as the national home of the Jewish people. This is not a topic of right wing or left wing. This is the security of Israel for our children, the land of the Jewish people. This is something that is a precondition to any negotiation.
The next speaker was Colonel Kemp, known to be a great friend of Israel, and he was received with a rousing applause.
We are not in need just of Israel victory. We're also in need of victory for the West, as I'll explain at the end of my brief comments. I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever that the peace process in the current form that it's being conducted cannot possibly work, whatever solution is hoped for at the end of it. Polls going back for more than a decade show that the majority of Palestinians, not just their leadership, the majority of Palestinian people reject a Jewish state in this land. They reject it totally, and they have done repeatedly over well in excess of a decade. And even if, in the unlikely event, the leadership of the Palestinians genuinely accepted a peace between themselves and the Jewish state, resistance would still continue until the land had been liberated from the Jews, from the river to the sea. That is, I'm afraid, in my opinion, a simple fact.
More from Colonel Kemp after the break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, and each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Resistance would still continue until the land had been liberated from the Jews, from the river to the sea. That is, I'm afraid, in my opinion, a simple fact. You can add to that the fact that there is continuing incitement and hate instilled in generation after generation after generation of Palestinian children. How can you possibly expect there to be a viable peace process which achieves a defined success when you've got the whole of the population of the people that you're negotiating with, who utterly reject you, hate Jews, hate Israelis, and hate Israel? It's a simple fact again. And finally, we can't have a viable peace process because the security situation does not, and is not likely, at any time in the foreseeable future, to allow it. It's impossible to allow the creation of a Palestinian state in any form without the presence of the Israel Defense Force there, because if that happened, then Israel itself would eventually be annihilated. Even if the Palestinians wanted to live in peace, that land would be infiltrated and taken over very, very quickly by Iran or by other jihadists in the region. So there can be no viable process. I think this situation that you face today is comparable to an insurgency. And insurgencies almost invariably succeed and cannot be beaten when they have outside support and safe haven. For example, in Northern Ireland, the terrorists there had support from the south, a safe haven as well. In Afghanistan, the terrorists had Pakistan. Iraq had Syria, and now Syria has Iraq. And in this case, it's not so much territorial in that way. What we're talking about is the external support coming from the international community. And the center of gravity, as we military people define it, in any insurgency, like any other conflict, is the decisive point that you need to either successfully attack and destroy or in some way affect and influence to your advantage, which brings you victory. And the center of gravity in this conflict is decisive international opinion and support for one side or the other. And it's not really good enough, in my opinion, to say support for both sides when you have people who are diametrically opposed to one another. The Palestinians understand this, both Hamas and the PA, and everything they do, whether it's diplomatic action involving the UN, the EU, etc., or whether it's terrorism, everything they do is based on influence on attacking the center of gravity of this conflict, the international community. We can, I say we, I'm not really we, the Israelis, I sort of, when I'm here, I do think of myself slightly as an Israeli. In my view, there is no doubt whatever that we, the Israelis, can cow the Palestinians by military force. We can annihilate them, literally. We can destroy their will to fight and the will to continue. I don't mean kill every single person, but it can be done. The problem is, they are not the center of gravity. The international community is. We cannot cow the international community. And actually, if we're talking about inflicting a crushing military defeat on the Palestinians to achieve victory, that is very likely to have the opposite effect of the effect we want to achieve. So it makes much more sense to talk about defeating the enemy's will to continue to fight. And examples of that occurring are Vietnam. In Vietnam, the Americans lost the will to fight. They weren't defeated militarily, they lost the will to fight on, and the other side won. In Northern Ireland, the British won. The British defeated the IRA by intelligence penetration, which prevented them from conducting any operations. They lost the will to fight on. They knew they couldn't, and they came to the negotiating table. And in Iraq, the US and the UK lost the will to fight. That was a slightly different case. And the case was really all about President Obama wanting to win the next election in the United States, hence him losing the will to fight and withdrawing all the forces. And we've got the current situation that we face there today, including the rise of the Islamic State as a consequence. The key to this is to make Israel's case against the dominant Palestinian narrative. We've all been saying it for a long time, we've all been trying it for a long time, but we have to, I think this caucus, this project, needs to focus itself on trying to persuade particularly the US government to take responsibility for pushing Israel's case against the Palestinian narrative. Not just defensively in terms of the legality and the moral rectitude of Israel's actions, which are beyond dispute, and also Israel's legal right to the land, which is beyond dispute. And I don't just mean Israel proper, I mean the whole of the land. It has a legal right to it under a number of treaties and resolutions, which I won't go into now, but you all know about them. I'm talking about also offensively. So placing, for example, the Palestinian refugee issue and right to return issue, placing that right at the centre of our offensive movement and driving that back. Okay, it's a final settlement agreement, but let's make this a part of our offensive operation against the Palestinians. So it's an information campaign to persuade Western governments not to accept the narrative, not to accept the agenda, not to accept the Palestinians' constant effort to isolate Israel and to turn Israel into an international pariah. The West must insist unequivocally on the historical connection of Jews to this land, and actions such as UNESCO's land in relation to Jericho, to Hebron, to various other matters they've ruled on recently, these undermine any of that action, and they encourage the Palestinians to go on and push on and demand more. We should demand that the PA also stop pushing that agenda, they stop inciting hatred, and we should cut off the funds to that organisation. My taxes in Britain pay for that incitement to hatred. The Arabs, as many other peoples, respect strength. They despise weakness. We showed them weakness in the Oslo Accords. We showed them weakness in Afghanistan and Iraq. The more concessions that are made and the more concessions that the international community try and pressure Israel to make simply show more and more weakness and are exploited more and more by the other side. finally, Europe is sleepwalking now into the same situation as you face here today. And European countries, including my own, have been making concession after concession after concession to radical Islam, and it's resulted in more and more advances by radical Islam across the continent of Europe. Now, we have an opportunity here, I believe, which might help us to achieve our objective in persuading the international community to take the right side and to apply the necessary pressure on the Palestinians. And that opportunity is presented, I think, by persuading European countries in particular that the problem they face today is exactly the same as the problem you face today. We in Europe face the same problem as is facing Israel, and it needs the same solutions. So I think that presents perhaps an opportunity, not just for victory here in Israel, but for victory in the West as well. Thank you.
The final speaker I have selected from about seven who were there is Melanie Phillips. She pulled no punches and was telling it how it really is.
This is a very much needed initiative. There is an urgent need to recalibrate the whole issue of the Arab war against Israel, to recalibrate it as one of war and victory, and to recalibrate it not just for the benefit of the Palestinians, but also for the West and also for Israel. We have to ask ourselves, surely, why do the Palestinians think the war is still on? Well, I think there are a number of reasons for that. One reason is that, unfortunately, if you are a religious Muslim, you believe that any land conquered by Islam is then consecrated to Islam, and nobody else can ever have sovereignty over it. So from that point of view, there can be no victory over that kind of religious fanatical mindset. But the main reason why the Palestinians think the war is still on is because they are encouraged to think that by the West, by Britain, by Europe, and also by Israel's great ally and friend, America. The Palestinian story has been accepted by the West to the extent to which it believes, the West, that there is a Palestinian people which has historic, national, and legitimate claim to the land. There never was a Palestinian people, there is not, and it doesn't now have any legitimate claim to the land whatsoever. Even if it did have a claim to the land, it would now be forfeit because of nearly a century of exterminatory aggression. In every other conflict in the world, that sort of exterminatory aggression means that the aggressors are treated as pariahs. Uniquely in this conflict, the aggressors over a century are treated, because of their aggression, as statesmen in waiting. It's not rocket science. If you treat aggressors as statesmen in waiting, you do not get peace and harmony. You get more aggression. Now, why has the West rewarded aggression in this way uniquely in this region? Many reasons. One is ignorance, one is malice, one is realpolitik, the desire to appease the Arabs over the oil weapon. Another reason is simply that people believe in the West, and I've heard this so many times, there is no alternative. But I would suggest that there's a deeper problem here. The prevalent view in the West is that the West no longer does war and victory. This is seen as uncivilized. War is seen as brutal, uncivilized, and must never be undertaken. If the Palestinians or the Arabs or the developing world is waging war, well, we expect that of them, don't we? Because they are basically uncivilized people. We do not expect them, apparently, in the West to accord with our own values of respect for human life, democracy, and all the rest of it. In other words, the West has a deeply racist attitude towards the developing world. And it believes in itself that it doesn't do war anymore because war is uncivilized. Instead of war, it does conflict resolution. It does law, not war. And so as a result, the war that's been taking place in this region by the Arabs against the Jewish homeland means that the West thinks that a compromise is essential. You have a war of extermination, put the two sides in the same room together, bang their heads together until they reach a compromise, because both sides, according to this view, have a legitimate claim to the same piece of land. In other words, the West has for nearly a century mistaken this whole conflict as a fight over land boundaries, whereas in fact it is a war of extermination. And where the West wants to press Israel to make compromise, every compromise that Israel has ever made is seen by the Arabs as a sign of weakness and an incentive to further aggression. And I would say the West's mistake, its conceptual, its fundamental mistake, perpetuates this conflict, indeed is a signal reason, possibly the main reason, why this conflict got underway in the first place. In the 1930s, Britain responded to the pogroms being committed by the Arabs of this land against the returning Jews and the violence committed against the then ruling British under the Palestine Mandate. Britain responded to that aggression by saying to the Arabs, have part of the land which we have undertaken by solemn agreement under international treaty obligation to give to the Jews. In other words, the original two-state solution was proposed in 1936 as a reward for exterminatory aggression and terror, and that continues to be the case today. But my final point is that the West needs to understand this, but my goodness, Israel needs to understand that this narrative has to change. Israel is most reluctant to say to the free world, to say to the West what it should be saying. Are you crazy? Why do you treat this conflict differently from all other conflicts? And until the West and until Israel actually understand that this conflict has to be reframed as one of war and victory, we are not going to get anywhere. Thank you.
It's time to end this program. So until next week, God willing, when I'll be back with more from Israel and the Jewish world, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good week, and make it also one for your elderly neighbor by dropping in to see how he or she is doing. Goodbye.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.